Get ready to whiten those knuckles and hold fast as we talk the most dangerous, daring, and epic sea stories ever told.
Whether facing ruthless men who prey on other mariners or storms that turn calm seas into graveyards, those who go down to the sea and cast off lines enter the most challenging and dangerous environment on Earth.
Only here will you hear their stories and the lessons gained through their experience. I'm your host, Phil.
And I'm Bill.
And we welcome you aboard the Had to Go Out podcast. Before we dive into this episode, we need to provide a disclaimer. The views expressed on this podcast are those of the individuals involved and are not to be construed as official or reflecting the views of any government agency or military service. This podcast is an independent effort with no government association.
When the most is expected, the brave men and women of the U.S. Coast Guard are always ready. The National Coast Guard Museum will engage, educate, and inspire visitors by honoring the courage and skill of our nation's unsung armed service. The museum will explore the Coast Guard's rich history and current impact through interactive exhibits, STEM-based learning experiences, and leadership development programming. Find out how you can join the effort. Become a plank owner today. Visit CoastGuardMuseum.org/out. That's CoastGuardMuseum.org/OUT.
Hey, welcome back everyone to another episode of They Had to Go Out. Thanks again for everyone that subscribed, followed, shared, done all the social media stuff to stay engaged with us.
If this is your first time listening to us, thanks a lot. We think we've got a really good one for you today. You're going to enjoy it. If you do enjoy it, please subscribe. Share or follow us on any social media platform you can think of. We're there.
And Bill says he thinks that we're going to have a good one today. I know we're going to have a good one today. Our guest today, I know well. He was my commanding officer when I was assigned to Station Marblehead up on the shores of the dangerous Lake Erie, which is much more dangerous than you may believe. But that was up in Ohio. Guest today, Mr. Sean McCarthy, born and raised in Long Island, New York. Joined the Coast Guard back in May of 1994. Went to boot camp with Company Kilo 144, for anybody interested. First operational unit was the Coast Guard cutter Whiteheath. Struck BM3 there, as all good bosun mates do. Didn't attend day school. Went from there to his first station, Fire Island, New York. Like many guys did at the time, advanced from BM3 to second all the way up to first before he transferred down to the Coast Guard cutter Farallon out of Miami, Florida, as the first lieutenant. Then he got XPO orders to Aunt Moriches up in Long Island. Did a little time there, made chief bosun mate, pinned on the anchor, headed to the Coast Guard cutter Dependable, where they put him in the ops job, which is just unbelievable to me because we all know that those are quartermasters and not bosun mates. I'm sorry, Bill.
There's no quartermasters anymore, Phil.
I know. Well, again, BMs assume every single rate in the Coast Guard. I don't know why we have any others.
That's fair. Neither do I.
But, realizing that life as a quartermaster was just not the same as life as a bosun mate, he went ahead and put in that warrant package, made bosun. Served a little time as the Aton officer at Sector Buffalo. Went from there where I met him as the commanding officer of Station Marblehead. Led the way, I know first person from a ton of good, dramatic, kind of heart-wrenching cases and a whole ton of law enforcement with stupid, crazy people. But we had a great time. Final unit was he taught seamanship to the recruits out in Cape May. And retired after, over 20 years of faithful service in 2014. And with that, I will let Bill ask our guest the question.
The question. All right, Mr. McCarthy. So what is your most dangerous, daring, or epic sea story or stories?
Well, thanks for having me, guys. Hopefully you can get some more subscribers and stuff. I really appreciate the opportunity to share my story. So I'm trying to think, as most bosun mates, you kind of look back on a lot of them and kind of think, well, that one was crazy, but I could definitely give you one on the top of my list that I honestly thought that I'd be swimming ashore outside of a boat. It was I was stationed at Fire Island. I think I was a BM-2 at the time. The coxswain was a BM-1, and I was a crewman. And
what, hey, sir, at Fire Island, just describe the station for anybody that's never been there, who's not familiar. Like, what kind of boats were you guys running?
Oh, yeah, no problem. So the Fire Island is on Long Island. It's right in the middle. They got Fire Island Inlet. And, you know, it's kind of funny. Back in the day, they always said it was, like, one of the busiest stations, you know, back before commercial salvage and stuff like that. So back then, we had a 41, 41395. We had a 44, 44341, and then we had a 21 RHI, and then we had a bunch of other boats that came in and out of there, whether, you know, it was a whaler one summer and got blown up to pieces and they didn't want to put money into it, to we had a 22-foot Ambar jet drive, self-righting, blah, blah, blah boat that, I don't know, in my opinion, somebody thought it'd be a great tool, but it was just a bathtub.
I feel bad for that whaler that you just described.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not going to guess who was driving that one, sir.
Wasn't this guy, I can tell you that. But I did have a good laugh. But anyway, it was great in the summertime, you know, super busy. I mean, there wasn't a weekend where you didn't run, you know, 25, 30 cases in a weekend, you know, whether it was, you know, a pickup a tow or a person in the water. So, I mean, summertime was great. You know, it's just always busy.
What about in the winter? Was it just dead? Like, just commercial traffic probably, huh?
Yeah, during the wintertime, we went 30 miles offshore. So, we were right on the edge of the Ambrose shipping lane. So, I mean, you would get, you know, some medical cases on some of the bigger ships coming in, and a lot of commercial fishermen getting in trouble out there. And it's funny, you look back on it now, we really didn't venture out offshore all that much, you know, with the 41 and the 44. I was there when they got the 47. And then, you know, it's funny, that extended our reach, and we were able to go offshore a lot more with the speed. So it was, you know, one of the beneficial platforms at that time.
Sure. All right, sorry I interrupted you.
No problem. So, you know, we had Fire Island Inlet, and I was fortunate enough, I grew up on Long Island, and that's where Fire Island was. And I always said, you know, I'd love to be stationed back at home. And it was pretty cool, because I was a commercial fisherman before I came into Coast Guard, and I pretty much knew the whole area. I know the inlet, knew, you know, all the little cuts in and out of the marshes, so I don't want to drag on, but anyway, on this particular day, our 44 was having a lot of electronics redone on it. I don't know if it was one of the SINS packages that were coming out or something. I just remember the boat wasn't operational.
Did 44s even have electronics? I thought you guys just, like, you had a magnetic compass and that was it.
They got radar.
Well, that's all we relied on, pretty much.
Yeah, right.
I mean, back then you had the Loran, which was down below, and there ain't a single soul I know that would ever go down below to look at it.
Well, Bill told us that he keeps his interpolator in his wallet. God knows why. So if you ever see him, ask for it, because it should. I think that deserves a beer.
Yeah. It's because I'm still carrying the same wallet from A school. That's why.
It was September, and, you know, during hurricane season, Long Island really doesn't get hit with them. They just come up and they curve out, but it created a pretty big swell off of Long Island. It was like 8 to 10, occasional 12s, and our inlet never really broke unless it was an outgoing tide, a strong outgoing tide. And I remember sitting at the station. It was beautiful out that morning. I mean, it was probably 6 foot, just easy rollers. Tide was coming in, so it was nice, and it was a hot day for September, and the boat traffic was just crazy going offshore. You had the jet skis out in the inlet, you know, it was a regular, you know, like, party day, you know, out there. And I don't know, it was probably like 3 o'clock in the afternoon, the tide changed, and I remember me talking with the BM1, Jim Weber. I'm like, man, that that inlet's going to end up breaking today, you know, straight across, because it always shoals up. I'm like, so anybody that went offshore this morning is going to come back, and they're not going to be prepared for that. So I said, you know, we're probably going to end up, you know, having to go out and escort people around and get them across, you know, whatever's breaking. No sooner did I say that, the SAR alarm went off. And I remember, man, we got up and ran, and it was for a report of a PIW in the inlet, in the surf.
And you guys aren't a surf station, right? So, like, Far Island, no. Just heavy weather, I'm guessing, right? You guys could...
You know, back then, Phil, I think it was 99, 98, somewhere around there. That's when the Coast Guard was trying to designate stations. Heavy weather, surf, this, that, the other thing. You know, and I remember going back and forth because the XPO at the time was Mark Davenport, who had come from the Motor Lifeboat School. You know, and his big thing was, you know, surf, 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 surf. You know, all the surfmen pounding their chest, and he used to laugh at Fire Island, be like, this isn't surf. You know, and all the bosun mates there were like, yeah, whatever. But anyway, the SAR alarm goes off, and the only platform that we have, really, to get out there is the 21. And there, the CO lived across the street, Mike Tollefson. So he heard the SAR alarm go off, and he heard surf in it. So he came running across the street, and, you know, we're getting our gear on, getting ready to head out there, and he looked at me and the other BM1, Jim Weber, and he's like, you guys going to take the RHI? And we're like, yeah, you know, we're going to go do what we can with the RHI. And I just remember, you know, full throttle heading out towards the inlet, you know, boats everywhere. You're like, man, this is crazy. And we got to the inlet, and sure enough, the tide had changed, and it was breaking a solid 8. We had a strong offshore breeze, so, you know, it was like one of those perfectly clean surf days if you're a surfer. And it was pretty incredible to watch, you know. And I remember sitting just inside the inlet and seeing these guys on jet skis. And they're, like, standing on the jet skis pointing. And I'm like, I tell the BM1, I'm like, over there, just outside of the channel. You could see, like, I don't know, had to be like 4 or 5 jet skis all in a circle. Then a wave would come, and they'd disappear. I'm like, it's got to be over there. So Jim takes the boat, and, you know, we're dodging in and out of, you know, breakers, because it was only breaking, like, literally in the middle of the channel because of how much it shoals up. And we get out there, and there's a jet skier holding on to a guy next to him. So me and the MK3, we grab him, bring him on the boat. He's all banged up. He's got a life jacket on. His back was all screwed up. So we move him to the back of the boat. And I'm asking him, like, you know, what were you on? He was on a 26-foot or a 28-foot lures wooden boat. And I'm like, well, what happened to the boat? And he's like, they started surfing down the front of a wave coming in the inlet. And he's like, we just lost it. The boat rolled and broke into pieces.
Yeah, just broached it straight down the face, huh?
Yeah, yep, broached straight down the face. He said it turned towards the right. And he said, next thing you know, he was in the water. And I'm like, well, how many people were on the boat? He's like, there's me and 4 other people, his wife and another couple and a guy that owned the boat. So I, you know, 21's pretty small. And the BM1 at the time, he's watching the waves. And he's like, you know, hang on. And, you know, we go up over a wave.
Yeah, and this 21 serves like, I mean, you're talking about the horse seats, right? The saddle seats?
The what?
Does it have, like, the saddle seats where you just kind of straddle it? Like, it almost like you're sitting on a horse?
No, this one only had the back post where you leaned up. There were no seats.
Oh, okay, all right, yep. Okay, so yeah. Rigid hull inflatable with, you know, where does the... And you guys are just putting your back against the padded part, right?
Yeah, whoever was driving.
Yeah, bend your knees.
me and the MK3, we're holding on to the radar arch and the handle on the post that you lean against, you know. And I got this guy on the floor behind there, and I, at the time, I was an EMT, so I'm trying to give him medical care. He's like, I'm fine. So just as I look up at Jim, I said, okay, there's 4 other people. I hear the engines on the RHI, they start cavitating. And I'm like, man, we didn't run aground. I'm looking around at the MK3, and the MK3 is over the stern looking back there, and he looks and he tells the BM-1, you know, bring up the starboard engine. Well, we had sucked up the canvas of the boat that was underwater.
Yeah, from the one that broached. So it went down and left the canvas floating, and you guys got it.
Yeah, and we didn't see it in the white water. And when we picked this guy up, we ran it over. So now here we are.
Drive. Yeah.
We're just inside the brakes at this point, because that's where we turned to head in to bring this guy.
Of course you are, because where else would things go wrong?
Right.
Yeah, you know, I mean, why not? So the MK3 is trying to get it out of there. Now, the tide at Fire Island runs probably 3.5 to 5 knots on an outgoing. You know, a good tide, it rips right through there. We start getting sucked out, and I'm looking at the MK3. He's looking at me. We got this guy down. The BM-1 is trying to start, and he's got him full throttle, and we're not moving. I'm like, holy. I looked at the MK3. He looked at me, and we're holding on to the radar arch. And I looked at him. I said, listen, if we got to go, we got to go. Let's start popping flares. The second we hit the water, just start popping. Because the BM-1's on the radio. He's actually calling Mayday on our channel 23.
Oh, man, that does not. That's a rare one.
So this is a BM-1 back at the station, Randy Ryan. He's hearing us. He was the OOD. Now, the CO's in the comm center. He's hearing us. The BM-1 had already relayed that there's 4 other PIWs that we can't find. The jet skier had grabbed 1 other one, but there were still 3 unaccounted for. So we're trying to get this thing unfouled. And it's not working. The MK3 is looking at me. He's like, I'm going. He's like, I'll swim right to the beach, man. He's like, it's me or you. And I'm like, I'll do the same. Let's huddle together. You know, you start thinking about that, and you're coming up with a game plan because you're not moving. You know, and you know the surf is going to flip us. It's going to spit us out in a second. So we're sitting there. All of a sudden, the BM1's like, hold on. And I look, and of course, the sea story, I'm going to say, you know, if you're on a 21, it had to be a 10 to 12 foot break.
You should have seen the smile that just spread across my face as you were like, I was like, how big is this thing going to be? No.
40 foot way.
Yeah, you know, I want to say it was like 80 foot, you know, like, you know, deadly as cat, but no.
Yeah, when you're in
like 80 feet on
when you're in a bad spot just sitting there, I mean, it's going to look bigger.
Yeah, you're sitting in a bathtub, and we're not moving. Finally, the BM-1 got enough, but he's full throttle. He gets the bow into this thing, guys. And the wave comes over the top of us. And I just remember looking down, because I'm looking to jump off the boat. I'm like, which way am I going? I looked clear down the tube on both sides of this wave, almost like I'm surfing. And I'm looking, and I could see the MK3 next to me. He's white as a ghost. I'm pretty much crap in my pants. I'm like, this is real, you know? And the BM-1 was holding on to the wheel of that boat so hard. I just remember seeing his hands gripped, and I'm like, I don't have anything to grip onto. I'm going over. And sure enough, we, for some reason, we porpoised right through it.
Wow.
And I'm looking at this. Yeah, I'm looking at the MK3. We're finally out of it. By this time, the radar antenna is gone. Both of our antennas are gone. The actual big radar arch on the back of the boat is bent probably 30 degrees back. And what kept him and I in the boat is when that wave broke, we both turned our backs and turned inboard. And we were pressed against that cage.
Yeah.
And, you know, self-bailing boat. Finally, we're through that one, and, you know, obviously we're looking for the next one, and right. We got a little bit more power, and we got another one. We made it over the top, and then we started cutting over. We had a east and west bar, and we started cutting over to the other bar, and that's when we finally got the other, it came clear somehow. We got everything out of the props, the BM-2, the BM-1 on the helm. He's like, I see two people. So we go over and we pick up two people in a life jacket, a lady and a guy. They were huddled together, you know. And I'm sitting there. I'm like, we have no radio. The jet skiers are like, what do you want us to do? And I remember Jim telling one of the jet skis, he's like, run into the Coast Guard station and tell them to send out whatever boats are left to come get us. Just send them, because nothing worked on our boat. And I remember we pulled these two people in, and now we had three people. The jet skiers had picked up the other two. And we're sitting, like, just outside the surf zone trying to deliberate, okay, how are we getting back in, you know? We really didn't... I assessed some injuries on these three people, the two guys and a lady, and the second-to-last guy we picked up, his back was messed up. I mean, I don't know how he was moving. I mean, he was in, like, excruciating pain. So I get the lady settled, and I start tending to him, and I'm looking at him, and I look up, and sure enough, here comes the 44. I don't know... The BM-1 got this boat fired up. He threw, I guess it was like 4 ETs on the boat, you know, trying to put electronics on it as quick as he can. But they had none. The boat was stripped. They had handheld radios with them on the 44.
I mean, you know, when your buddies are out there calling Mayday, you're going to do whatever it takes to get out there, right? Yeah, you're going to get it. Somebody's coming with me. We've got a lot more of this episode to go, and we'll get right back to it after this short ad from our sponsor. We're going to give you a key number about the future National Coast Guard Museum, and that number is 5.
There are 5 themed storylines: lifesavers around the globe, enforcers on the seas, defenders of our nation, champions of commerce, and protectors of the environment.
The exhibits and galleries in those storylines will be showcased in a 5-story museum.
And here's our favorite 5. For as little as $5 a month, you can be a plank owner and support construction of the National Coast Guard Museum.
For details on how you can get involved, go to CoastGuardMuseum.org/out. That's CoastGuardMuseum.org/OUT.
And, you know, I sit and think about it now, and you kind of, you know, years ago it was, you know, make best with what you have. You know, you got to do it. You know, it didn't matter, you know, about a computer system telling you the boats and maintenance or whatever. You did it, you know. And that's the thing I'm fortunate about, because the leadership back then let you do it, you know, and make those decisions. But anyway, we're getting situated. We're offshore. Now 65 comes. And, you know, it's a good 8 to 10 foot rollers. Nothing crazy once you're offshore, because we had the north wind. And I'm sitting there, and I'm like looking at the BM-1. I'm like, all right, well, we can transfer these people to the 44. Randy can transit, bring them in, and then we can drive the 21 offshore, since it's breaking here. We'll go down to Station Jones Beach and go in. He's like, yeah, that's perfect. So we're alongside the 44 now. The rescue swimmer's in the water. He comes over to us. He starts assessing. You know, he's like, oh, we're going to take this one first, and, you know, the guy with the bad back, we'll soak slither him, and then we'll fly him. I'm like, okay, perfect. So leave him here. Let's get these other two onto the 44, and we'll go from there. He's like, perfect. So we transfer one male, one female over to the 44, and they're in pretty good spirits, you know. They're you know.
Yeah, they're back on a boat.
Yeah,
you know, she's thankful. I mean, she was crying. She was hysterical. She wanted to make sure that the other people were there, but you could see it in her face. She was genuinely thankful. So I'm sitting there as an EMP with the AST there, and we're assessing this last guy. So he's like, all right, the rescue swimmer, he's like, I'm going to go in the water, I'm going to receive the basket, because we were going up and down pretty good, and, you know, then we'll transfer on top of the turtleback. I said, okay, perfect. He's like, just take his life jacket off when I go in the water, you know, and then they'll do it. Well, I took this guy's life jacket off. He had one of the big orange around the neck life jackets, you know, guys, those ones you see, and people are like, oh, you look doofy.
Yeah, those weird survival ones, right? Like, not made to work in, just survive.
Yeah, exactly. So I take this guy's life jacket off, and this part gets a little graphic. Evidently, when the boat rolled, he was inside the cabin. Something had splintered, wood or something, and it sliced into his neck. When I took that life jacket off, it hit his jugular.
Oh, man.
And I'm sitting there. I take his life jacket off, and there was another kid, Adam Abreu. He was in the well deck of the 44 with me because I was packaging him up to get flown out. He almost passes out because the blood is like squirting at me, and I just instantly grabbed this guy by his neck.
You're an EMT, so I mean, you recognized it for what it was, right? You knew right away, like, hey, oh.
He's going to die if we don't do something.
Right.
There's no way he's going to survive. So I tell the BM1 that's driving the 44, I'm like, tell the helo, bring the rescue swimmer back down. They're going to have to they can't do a basket hoist. They've got to go up together because somebody has to keep direct pressure on this. Otherwise, he's not going to live. There's just no way. So the rescue swimmer comes back down. He's like, what's going on? And he could see all the blood all over me. He's like, okay. I don't even remember this kid or who he was. He's like, okay, he gets a harness on him, on the victim, and he's holding him, and they get hoisted up into the helicopter. And I'm just like, oh my God, today wasn't my day, you know? And I'm sitting there thinking, I'm like, holy crap. So the BM1 on the RHI with the MK3, they drive all the way down to the next inlet to come in. The lady and the guy that we have on board, I bring up into the forward survivor's cabin of the 44, and it's still breaking. And I'm looking at the BM1. I'm like, so we're just going to, he's like, no, you got to ride up there with him. I'm like, I can ride up there with him? He's like, yeah, you need to ride up there with him as an EMT. I'm like, oh my God. I'm sitting there thinking, I'm like, this goddamn thing rolls on me while I'm up here. I ain't going to be able to help her because I'm going to be scrambling to get out of this thing. I'm like, this is two times in one day. And he's looking at me. He's not, at the time, obviously, we're not laughing, you know. And I'm like, all right. So I put him and her up against the bulkhead on port and starboard side, and I'm one seat in next to the guy, you know. And during boat checks, you're always checking the seatbelts and everything. Well, I tell you what, I put that seatbelt on me so tight, I don't know how it stayed attached to the bulkhead. And I'm sitting there, and, you know, now the guy, and it's loud down there, and the woman, you know, asking me questions, you know, okay, so what's going to happen now? I'm like, well, you guys are seatbelted in, this boat self-rights. If something would happen like what just happened to your boat, this boat just rolls over, and we just keep going. As soon as I tell the lady that, I could see the look in her eyes.
Probably the wrong thing to bring up what just happened to their boat, huh?
You were basically like the stewardess right then, right? Like I could. Oh man, that poor lady.
Don't worry, the seat cushion provides flotation.
Yeah. So she looks at me, stone cold, straight face. She goes, "I am so scared. I just wet myself." And I looked, and sure enough. She's like, I am so sorry. I cannot hold it in. She goes, I am absolutely scared. And it was like, I'm looking at her. I'm like, holy cow. Now I'm thinking, I'm like, shit, what should I have said? Should I have not said that? And I'm sitting there. I'm like, no, you'll be fine. You'll be fine. The guy that's driving, really, and now I'm trying to reassure her. Well, anyway, the BM1 starts backing into the inlet, and we're backing up. And you don't realize how, I wouldn't say violent, but how uncomfortable it is. Sitting inside the forward compartment of a 44, seatbelted in, not being able to see and not know what's going on, you know?
Hey, and sir, I'm curious, like, so I've never actually been in a 44 in the surf, but on a 47, right, when it hits the wave, and I know they operate a little differently, they basically go through and over, right? Mostly over. But when they land, you get this like this violent vibration all throughout the boat. Is the same thing happening on a 44 up in that cabin?
No, you don't get any. That boat was so solid. There's no vibration, but it is. It almost feels like a slow death roll, you know, because he's backing and backing and backing, and as soon as it starts breaking, you know, neutral, and then you're just all the way ahead.
Yeah,
and you know you can feel it coming up the face of the wave, and then if it's just about living, it launches the front of the 44. That force. So when it comes down, and then you can feel the weight behind it, like the counterweights and the well deck and the engines, and it almost feels like you're going like porpoising, but you're not.
Yeah, like you're going to be filing a VA claim in a few years.
Right.
Yeah, and that's exactly it, you know. So I don't know. It took us maybe 10, 15 minutes to get through, but it felt like an eternity. And I'm not going to lie. You know, when people urinate themselves, it stinks, especially when you're in an airtight, pretty much cabin. So we get in and we get back to the dock, and this lady wants to clean the forward compartment. That's how embarrassed she is. I said, listen, it's all good. It's all fine.
We got nominees.
Yeah, we get back into port, and, you know, where ambulance is there and takes the two of them to the hospital and stuff like that. And, you know, I'm back at the station. Jim and Greg are still on the RHI trying to make way in 8 to 10 foot swells. I don't know. I think it was like 19 miles, 20 miles to the next inlet, something like that. And they're trying to get in down there, and obviously they're exhausted, you know. But anyway, we get back to the station. I get showered up, and a doctor from Nassau County Medical Center actually called the station and told them that, you know, told the CO that whoever decided to fly that guy made the right decision, because he wouldn't have survived an ambulance ride. So it was, you know, when you can say you contributed, and it wasn't just me. I mean, there was three of us on the RHI, to the ETs, to, you know, everybody back at the station, to be able to say that, you know, you contributed to literally saving a life. I don't think there's any other awesome feeling.
It almost gives me chills, right? Even hearing you say that the doctor called back and was like, hey, whoever decided to do that did the right thing.
That's ultimately why we do what we do, right, sir?
And that's what it is, you know? And you know, sometimes I feel that, you know, after being a CO at a station and stuff, you sit back and you look at some of these junior kids, you know, and you know they have the mentality to make these decisions. You know that they can, you know, solidly make a decision. And you want them to. You almost want them to make a decision like that, because you've done it before at the age of 23 or 22, you know. So that was probably, you know, one of the scariest cases I've ever been on, you know, from almost, you know, getting knocked in the water and coming up with a game plan and, you know, saying, hey, I got 7 flares and my Mark 79 and, you know, if we got to pop the other end, you know, then let's do it, you know. And
yeah, anytime you got an inventory survival gear, right, is a scary moment, I would think, in life.
I think you hit the dangerous, daring, and epic.
Yeah, I think you hit all three, sir. Yeah.
You know, and it's something that you realize at the time was pretty cool, but as you get older, you're like, man, you know, those decisions that you make, there's no other, you know, for most of the kids, there's no other job like it. There really isn't.
No, and I think, you know, one of the decisions that you guys made, sir, that we haven't really even talked about, was you guys just got, you know, almost got rolled by this wave, right? It's caused all this damage, and it wasn't even a question, it seems like. You guys immediately went over to the two people that were still in the water and recovered them. There wasn't even a pause in your voice when you talked about it. It was like, hey, we came up, we had all this damage, we're on the backside of the wave, looking for the next one, and then we went over and we got these two people.
Yeah, nobody's inventorying. Is that a disabling or a restrictive casualty?
Right, yeah. There was no question like, hey, are we going back or are we going to save these people? No, we're going to save them. It's not even a question.
And that's, you know, you guys bring up a good point. Is that disabling? Is that a restrictive? You know, I sit and look at boats nowadays, and, you know, I get baffled by, you know, this doesn't work, so we can't use it, or that doesn't. And I get it. It's all for safety. I get it. You know? But there comes a point where, you know, you got to draw the line sometimes and just, you got to go and do it, you know? And I think that was one of the cases where, you know, even the 44, in today's standards, if that was a 47 with no electronics and stuff like that, that boat would have never left the dock, I would imagine, with 80% of the COs or OICs today. They wouldn't even thought of it, you know?
And, yeah, if there was a nav light out, I mean, right, it might not need to leave the dock.
Exactly, you know? Yeah. And it's good stuff, you know? I mean, it was a fun job. It was a fun station. And, you know, I, I look back on those crazy cases like that over the years, and when you make a career out of doing what you love to do and being part of the Coast Guard, when you're doing it, you don't realize the impact or the amount of stuff you've done in 20 years until one day when you retire and you no longer do it. That's when it makes an impact on you. That's when you can sit back and say, you know, I remember this. Or, you know, when you guys asked me to do the podcast, it was like, man, what story do you pull? You know, and I think most men and women that retire from the Coast Guard or even spend 4 years can honestly say, you know, what story do you want to tell, you know?
Yeah, we keep, you know, it's a common theme, too, is that even, you know, a guy like yourself, right, that did more than enough time to retire, all these stories that come fresh to mind are always the ones where you were the most junior. You know, you're a BM2 out there making it happen, and we've had guys that were BM3s and non-rates even. Yeah. So it always comes back to that those first couple years is where, you know, some of those awesome decisions and lessons were learned.
Yeah. And that's, you know, those are the lessons that you take with you when you move up. You know, everybody always says, you know, leadership can be taught. But to me, I think that's a bunch of crap. Leadership can't be taught. Leadership is based on experience, period. That, to me, you can't validate that any other way of being a good leader unless you've experienced it. To know enough to tell a kid, listen, go. You got to go out. You know, go do your job. You know, make those decisions. I can't make them for you out there, you know.
Right. I remember, you know, just to bring it back to a time when you and I served together, I remember something that was going on, and one of the qualified coxswains didn't want to take the boat in, you know, seas that were well within his letter, right? And I remember your reply was, well, I certified you to the letter, so if you don't think you can do it, I'm pulling your letter. And that was it. I thought that was like, you know, what a great motivator, and basically the you saying, hey, I got faith in you to go out there and make it happen.
Yeah,
I thought that was, I still remember that.
Yeah, but those are the things that make, you know, I think, the great leaders in the Coast Guard. You know, and don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that I was the best or this one was the best, but, you know, at the end of the day, to validate how good you are, I think is affording the younger kids that are operating to go and do their job. That's what they're there for. That's what they want to do. They don't want to be told what to do when you're a coxswain, you know? I mean, did you want to be told what to do, Phil, when you were a coxswain?
No way. I just talked to a guy that enlisted in 1967 the other day, and he told me that the only reason he went bosun mate was so that he could tell everybody to pack sand when they walked on his boat.
Hell yeah. I think that's classic. That's a good representation of being a coxswain. You know, and I kind of look at it now. I'm retired and I own a business. Well, owning a business and being a coxswain are almost one in the same, because the decisions I make today puts food on the table tomorrow for me now being retired. The decisions I made years ago as a coxswain depended on who went home at night. You know what I'm saying?
100%.
Who got picked up? So, I mean, there's a lot of life lessons that can be taken from your younger years in the Coast Guard and you know, just put forward and you know, make you a better person, period. So
solid, sir. Solid summary and advice there, I think.
Yeah, get out there and sums it up.
Get out there and do it, basically, yeah. Right? Yeah, while you still can. Hey, sir,
yeah.
we so appreciate you telling the story. I know you've got many more. I would love to have you, Bill and I both would love to have you back on for the TWA Flight 800 story. I know that you've, you know, you responded to that at one time. And,
yep.
You know, anybody that's been on a 110 out of Miami's got some stories down there, I'm sure.
Stories there.
Yeah, we'd love to have you back on sometime, sir, when you got a free minute.
Absolutely. Just get in touch with me, and hopefully, you know, this will get some people to subscribe and listen to it, and you know, it's a great thing what you guys are doing, so I totally support it. Anytime you guys need me, or I'm pretty sure I'll run out of stories eventually.
Well, fair enough. You know, we all do. We can just retell them another way.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Unless you want to hear about lawn mowing, but I don't think that this is part of your podcast. So.
Well, speaking of that, sir, you know, we always like to ask what you guys are up to, you know, what any of our guests are up to now, and, you know, how our listeners can help support you being willing to share your story and those lessons you learned.
Yeah, no problem. You know, I retired and I opened up a landscaping business, and, you know, I work at my own pace and I try to provide the best service, you know, to all my customers. And, you know, after I retired, I asked a landscaper. Guy had like 10 guys and, you know, 5 trucks at this apartment complex. I'm like, man, how did you get so big? He goes, just remember one thing in any business. It's all about putting bread on the table at the end of the day, period. And I've kind of taken that ever since then, and, you know, making a business decision, it's all about putting bread on the table, you know. So even if some of the junior people that are listening that are looking to get out, you know, it's not easy on the outside. But, again, the biggest thing is, you know, just putting bread on the table at the end of the day for your family and taking care of them. So.
Yeah, and to kind of build up your, you know, your post business, what's the name of it again, sir?
My company's called Veterans Seasonal Services up in Buffalo, New York. And, you know, we do commercial, residential, landscaping, snow plowing, and try to make our customers happy.
That's what I was going to say. You're being a little modest, because I've seen some pictures of the company development that have come out, and you're constantly procuring new gear to take on new missions. So I know yours is a successful one, but, you know, for all of our listeners out there, you know, whether you live in Buffalo or not, I would suggest Veteran Seasonal Lawn Services deserves a few 5-star reviews, because we know who the leadership is, and he does a pretty damn good job.
Yeah, that'd be awesome. I'd appreciate it, guys. That's for sure.
Do you got a website, sir?
Yep. It's www.vetcserve.com.
Awesome, sir.
Nice.
Hey, we'll try and drive as much traffic as we can for you. And again, sir, a huge privilege having you on. I learned a lot myself from you over the years, and even during this podcast. Every time I talk to you, it's eye-opening in some way. So thank you.
Yeah, no problem. You guys are doing a great job. I appreciate the opportunity.
No, thank you very much, sir. Really appreciate your time. That was it's a great story.
Awesome.
All right, sir. We'll talk to you again later. Enjoy this weekend.
You got it. Yeah, you too, guys. Thank you. Stay safe.
You too.
Bye.
Before we end this, we want to give a plug for some people and organizations that we believe in.
The Coast Guard Foundation supports the brave men and women of the Coast Guard when they need it the most, providing everything from financial aid to families in crisis to scholarships and playground equipment. As a nonprofit 501c3 charity, they count on our donations to deliver this support. Visit CoastGuardFoundation.org. That's CoastGuardFoundation.org to read about their programs and donate what you can to support those who guard our nation's coast.
Another one to check out is the Always Ready Collective, which delivers art by and for some daring fighters of the sea. Head over to Etsy, Facebook, or Instagram and search Always Ready Collective to check out their Coast Guard and Maritime-focused tattoo flash, pinups, and propaganda. You won't be disappointed. Anyone who gets one of their designs inked on their body will get featured on their feed and can be sent a care package on the house. Find a design you like, some blank canvas, and get it done. Thanks for taking the time to listen.
If you like what this podcast is about and what we delivered, look us up at theyhadtogooout.com or your favorite podcast platform. And like, comment, subscribe, and share so we can keep the momentum up and do bigger things going forward.
Look for a new episode every Sunday. Until then, fair winds and following seas.